The Roots of Obama's Rage by Dinesh D'Souza, continued. Disc 4. Chapter 6. Becoming Barack. Becoming part of the Third World, writes Shiva Naipaul in Black and White, is to some degree a psychological process, a quasi-religious conversion. It is, at bottom, a mode of being, a state of mind. That state of mind spreads like an infection and begins after a while to create its own political, social, and personal realities. And so it is with our man in the White House. Here we examine how Obama went from being Barry to being Barack. In other words, how he formed his adult identity and the core of his ideological convictions. In a way, we can see the transition in his name itself. At Punahou, he was always Barry. At Occidental, a girl he liked inquired about his given name, and he said it was Barack, which meant blessed in Arabic. The girl, Regina, thought that sounded cool and asked if she could call him Barack. He agreed, but everyone else still called him Barry. Then Obama met an older student, Eric Moore, who told him he had been to Kenya and worked in a rural clinic near Lake Victoria, not far from where Barack Sr. was born. Excited to find someone who had actually been to his father's country, Obama asked Moore to tell him everything about Kenya. Later, Moore said, "In some ways, I knew more about him than he knew about himself at that point." Moore, who was African American, asked Obama, "What kind of a name is Barry for a brother?" Obama told him his real name was Barack. Moore responded, "That's a very strong name." Moore made it a point to call him Barack, and so did some of his close friends. Still, it was not until Obama transferred to Columbia University that he made the transition from Barry to Barack. This was around 1982, the year his father died. That name change is symbolic of a deeper change in Obama. But we cannot discover that change by tracking Obama's career as a community organizer. Obama did move to Chicago to gain political experience as a young activist. He worked for a church-based outfit that used the techniques of the Chicago radical Saul Alinsky. And Obama was able to ride his activist credentials to the State House, getting himself elected state senator when the frontrunner was disqualified on a technicality. But Obama's early political career is largely inconsequential because he accomplished very little. As a state senator, he usually showed up, listened to the debates on the various issues, and robotically voted present. He voted present more than 100 times. He made an abortive run for Congress in 2000 and lost badly in the Democratic primary. No one at that point would have predicted Obama's future. Obama himself was biding his time, going through the motions. The real action of his life was indeed elsewhere. Before we get to that action, it is helpful to spell out an important choice that Obama had to make about what kind of black politician he was going to be. Recall from the previous chapter Obama's recognition that white America had been shamed by its history of slavery and racism. And this shaming had resulted in an accumulation of white guilt. This white guilt has in our day become a fund of political and financial capital for blacks to draw on. But a certain degree of black acting out is required to capitalize on this opportunity. In Chicago, where these thespian techniques had been virtually perfected, Obama realized that he had three options. The first option was black nationalism. In Chicago, where Obama encountered it, this took the shape of the Nation of Islam. In Dreams from My Father, Obama relays his conversations with a black nationalist named Rafiq al-Shabazz. In this case, as with other characters, the real Rafiq, whose name is Salim al-Nuruddin, turns out to be somewhat different from the character Obama depicts. Even so, Obama's Rafiq is over the top, a bit of a cartoon character. Obama has little difficulty resisting his militant rhetoric. Obama's real problem with black nationalism emerges when he discusses Louis Farrakhan's solution for the African American community, economic self-help. Obama notes that Farrakhan's newspaper, The Final Call, had been thick with promotions for a line of toiletries, toothpaste, and the like, that the nation had launched under the brand name Power, part of a strategy to encourage blacks to keep their money within their own community. Over time, however, the ads for Power products grew less prominent in The Final Call. It seems that many who enjoyed Minister Farrakhan's speeches continued to brush their teeth with Crest. This is the sole moment of humor in Obama's book, and it emerges from his contempt for a strategy that seeks black uplift through black self-financing. Obama's objection seems to be not merely that blacks aren't loyal to black products, it is also that in America, by and large, blacks are not where the money is. This brings us to Obama's second option, which is the Jesse Jackson option, otherwise known as the shakedown. Unlike Farrakhan, Jackson knows exactly where the money is. Over the years, Jackson has figured out how to approach corporations from Coke to NASCAR, threaten them with public accusations of racism, and then blackmail them into paying off Jackson's Operation Push, hiring blacks whom Jackson recommends, and diverting a percentage of their business to minority businesses of Jackson's choosing. Jackson has flourished through his godfather position at the head of a kind of black mafia. What makes the operation especially impressive is that, unlike the real mafia, Jackson can get his results without having to break heads, and moreover, he can look like he's doing a lot of good for society while he is doing very well for himself. Obama is very careful in discussing the Jackson option in his book. He doesn't want to alienate Jackson. And neither does he want to offend the Chicago political machine, run at the time by such racial scam artists as Chicago Mayor Harold Washington and U.S. Senator Carol Mosley Braun of Illinois. That machine also operated on race-based patronage. Still, despite their recognition that whites are the ones who have the money, the shakedown artists have a problem which Obama was quick to discern. The problem is that people who are intimidated into paying up are likely to be very resentful of the person who shakes them down. Besides, they are forking over only a small portion of their funds. So a relatively small monetary gain comes with a big loss of white political support. Jackson may fly around in a private jet, courtesy of some CEO who provided it to beat the racism rap, but notice that Jackson tried twice to run for president and did not even come close to winning the nomination. Most likely today, he could not be elected to any statewide office. Therefore, Obama turned to a third option, and this is the one that has worked well for him. It is the non-racial option, the option of seeking to organize on a community basis in order to advance himself politically. Not that Obama was against the idea of a shakedown, it's just that he wanted a bigger, more effective shakedown. What could be better than getting people to give voluntarily, even happily? Saul Alinsky helped Obama see how he could get whites to become accessories in such a large-scale project. Alinsky's Rules for Radicals is dedicated to a most unusual figure who is credited with being the very first radical. That figure is Lucifer, otherwise known as Satan. Not content with having Satan on his side, Alinsky also acknowledges his debts to Niccolo Machiavelli, but with one distinction. The Prince was written by Machiavelli for the haves on how to hold power. Rules for Radicals is written for the have-nots on how to take it away. Alinsky's context was American, yet his rules could easily be adapted to Obama's anti-colonial outlook. Alinsky could show him how, working on behalf of the wretched of the earth, he might bring down the haves and seize power. Despite his book's title, the most important aspect of Alinsky was not his radicalism, it was his pragmatism. Alinsky argued that blacks cannot succeed without the support of whites. More broadly, the folks at the bottom of society cannot win without making an alliance with, or at least manipulating, the folks in the middle. And even some folks at the top. Even if all the low-income blacks, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and even poor Appalachian whites come together, the coalition would fail because it would not have enough power to make a real change. Alinsky's point was to call for a politics that transcends race and even class. He did so not to fulfill some multicultural vision, but simply because of the political reality that no radical change, radical in the sense of going to the root of things, was possible without including the white middle class in such a coalition. Alinsky admitted that the white middle class was provincial, selfish, and often antagonistic to immigrants and minorities. Still, with careful crafting, it was possible to devise a message that would bring these folks on board. Basically, you have to create alienation, to cut this group from the power bases in society, to intensify its feelings of hopelessness and frustration. Go in and rub raw the sores of discontent, Alinsky advised. We'll give them a way to exercise their rights as citizens and strike back at the establishment that oppressed them. This, Alinsky concluded, was the way to sell the middle-class majority on a politics that would normally be alien and unpalatable. For Obama, here was an unforgettable lesson in political packaging and marketing. While Alinsky was an important instructor in tactics, another figure, and this time quite a character, played a crucial role in solidifying Obama's core identity. Approximately 2 decades ago, while he was working as an activist in Chicago, Obama came to the Trinity Church in order to hear its pastor, Jeremiah Wright. Obama was not particularly religious. In fact, when pastors asked which church he attended, he typically hemmed and hawed. But in The Audacity of Hope, Obama writes, "I was drawn to the power of the African-American religious tradition to spur social change." Trinity, Obama had heard, was that kind of church. Obama's interest was sharply boosted when he saw a sign spiked into the grass outside the church building, "Free South Africa." In the Reverend Wright, Obama encountered a man who frequently wore a dashiki or other African garb. A charismatic figure who was also an intellectual, Wright was capable of moving between the First World and the Third World, and of blending literary and political references with his biblical themes. The sermon Obama heard that first day was called The Audacity of Hope. It was a cosmopolitan address. Wright spoke of hardship in America, but he also spoke of Sharpeville, South Africa, and Hiroshima. Wright said, "The world seems on the brink of destruction. Famine ravages millions of inhabitants in one hemisphere, while feasting and gluttony are enjoyed by inhabitants of another hemisphere.